Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be talking about the camouflage problem of weight, something that so many of us struggle with. And I'll be playing the first half of an interview with Keith Fitzgerald, state representative from Sarasota, Florida. Hang on. Here come the show. Show. Welcome back if you've been listening. Welcome, welcome if this is the first time you've heard the show. As I often do, I try and do all the time, but sometimes I forget. I like to tell people what to expect because the Lynn Show doesn't actually say it. Well, it does actually say it since I can pretty much do whatever I want, but then how would you know what I want? So I like to say what you can expect. What you can expect from me, generally speaking, is that in the first half of the show, I will be working through the concepts in my book. The book is called When You Can, You Will. It's about why we can't make the changes in our life that we think we want to make, that we may believe we have to make, even, when we want to make them. It's clear to me in my 30-some years of private practice as a psychotherapist, that wanting and trying is just not enough. I know that it's the conventional wisdom. I know that most of us still believe that if we just wanted it enough and we just tried hard enough, we ought to be able to do it. But my experience, personal and clinical, is that sometimes, even a lot of the time, wanting and trying is not enough. And when it's not enough, then finding out what is getting between you and the change you want to make is what will make the difference. And the book, When You Can, You Will, is all about what the kinds of things that get between us and the changes we want to make, and also the way in which we are protected from making changes prematurely. So, in the last month or so, I've been talking about the potential dangers of change. We're an optimistic, goal-oriented society, and we like to look at the advantages, the goals of everything we want to do. So we rarely look at what could go wrong. Unfortunately, while our conscious mind and our culture is looking at what we want to happen, we are not aware that there are quite often dangers that are not clear to us, or at least not clear to our conscious mind. But our unconscious mind sees those dangers and stops us from making changes that are going to endanger us until we're ready to deal with them or out of danger. So the last month or so, I've been talking about the unconscious and how it does that, how it either diverts us or gives us information. I talked about the tricks that our unconscious uses to either give us information that we didn't have, that our conscious mind doesn't have, things like the well-known Freudian slip and the inner DJ, and then ways that it has of distracting us, like giving us the wandering mind or helping us to forget to remember. And in this show, I'm going to continue to talk about the big trick, the trick of camouflage. What you see is not really what you get. The hand is quicker than the eye. Look over here, not over there. I've been doing interviews, a series of interviews actually, called Anatomy of an Artist. And I've been interviewing singers, musicians, architects, and the people who support their careers, like music business attorneys and agents. In this show and next week's show, this is something of a departure, although in some ways it isn't. I'm interviewing Keith Fitzgerald, who is a state representative for the city of Sarasota, a district in the city of Sarasota. And Keith is also a political science teacher. He teaches at a university here. And he's passionate about citizen involvement in the democratic process and about knowing where we came from and what politics is really all about. And so in this interview, which was so long that I had to break it up into two, and you'll get the first half this week and the second half next week, Keith is talking at length about these two things, which are passions of his, why it is important for citizens to participate in the democratic process, in the political process, and of course that's why he ran for office, and also what it means to be a good politician. And because Keith thinks of politics as not only a profession or a science, but also as an art, there is an art to being a good politician. In that way, this interview is consistent with my anatomy of an artist, because Keith views himself as an artist and anyone who is really good at politics as an artist. And these interviews, I've said a number of times when I've talked about it, they amount to a mini course in political science. They are fascinating and, of course, completely appropriate as we are coming in on the election. So the first half of the show this week will be dedicated to my first half of my interview with Keith. And then I'll continue to talk about the camouflage trick of weight and how that protects us from changes that we may not yet be ready to make. But now, without waiting any longer, because this is so important, here is the first half of my interview with Keith. Okay, so I'm here with Keith Fitzgerald in his campaign office,
right,
as opposed to his
legislative district office.
And Keith is the representative from
District 69, which is most of the north half of Sarasota County, Florida, and a small part of the southern part of Manatee County.
And I worked on Keith's campaign last year, his first campaign.
Right.
And I worked on that campaign because I heard him speak and I wanted him to get it.
Thanks.
I have not participated all that much in the political process myself. The first campaign I worked on was Jan's, and that was a heartbreak, the first one.
That was the first campaign you ever worked in?
Uh-huh, yeah. I had to wait, actually, to come to Sarasota to get close enough to the process to find people that I wanted to support. And so I worked for her, and I worked for you. And I wanted to interview Keith because he has so much to say about things that I think matter. And we've been chatting before the interview started, and we were talking about truth in politics. And something I heard him talk about early on, which is citizen participation in the process. Keith teaches...
Political science at New College of Florida.
Yeah.
And I do a little bit of political theory and American politics.
And if I remember correctly, you talked about this whole issue of citizen participation, did you not?
It's a big part of what I studied academically, but it's also something I've always been engaged in. So I've thought about it both at the practical level and the theoretical level.
Yeah, for me, you combine these two things, the academic, theoretical, and then you... surprisingly, it seems to me, have this capacity for the practical. I think it's an unusual combination.
I think it's pretty unusual, and there are a lot of reasons why it's unusual. It shouldn't be, but it is. One is that as somebody who does political theory, there's a prejudice we have deeply ingrained in our culture, and it probably begins at least with Plato, moving forward, that theory and philosophy should be separated from politics, and that politics among theorists and philosophicals and by extension intellectuals is seen as a degraded realm, and intellectual life is seen as superior.
Oh, yes, it's the, what are the... the divisions?
Right.
The
philosopher king should be removed from the grubbiness of day-to-day life and be thinking loftier thoughts. In the United States, we regard anyone who's an intellectual or thoughtful or has some specialized knowledge about anything, really, is immediately suspect. We like men and women of action. And unfortunately, that sometimes means, as I think you see with our present president, an actual prejudice against using thought as part of action.
Yes.
And now there's a totally different model, if you want to go back to the Greeks. It was the model that Thucydides wrote about it in his book on the Peloponnesian Wars. And the most famous part of that was the Pericles' funeral oration, where Pericles gets up and talks about what politics looks like in a democracy. And he praises combination of thought and action, that actively engaged citizens are to be praised by their ability to persuade people through words and to move them to action with those words. And that's a model, that combination of those two things is a counter model. Plato wrote after the fall, the political chaos that ensued after the Peloponnesian Wars, and it sort of were divorce papers sent by intellectuals to the political more practical community, and again in the United States, the other side is fired back. We really tend to think that people who think too much are probably effete and
yes,
weak,
right?
And you know, this president really manifests that in a big way. I mean, he almost at the level of theory. As a theoretical commitment, he thinks if you think too much, you must be wrong.
Yeah.
And that's obviously terribly dangerous. So, you know, somehow we've got to get... Now, there's a counter tradition in the American case that is homegrown, also has its roots in a way in Greece, and it's called pragmatism. Pragma is a Greek word for... thoughtful action. The American philosophers actually cooked this up. You know, the idea that thought is best informed when it's mixed with reality and tested against reality. And the truth really is based in action. It's your willingness to act on a proposition that makes it true rather than some abstract characteristic of the proposition. So you can't really have action without thought and thought without action. And you shouldn't try to figure out what the truth is without testing it out in reality.
You can have thought without action and action without thought, but it's not as
viable. Right. They're not fulfilling the potential that each ought to have if they're divorced from the other.
Yes. So I'm finding this so interesting because instinctively, it seemed to me that your capacity, I mean, I didn't think you could do it.
Win?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody thought I could win. Although, after the fact, it turns out there are more people claimed they thought that I could win. Because a lot of people have a piece of credit and they take it, and that's good because that's it's appropriate. Everybody, including you who worked in it, should claim a piece of credit and ownership for the victory. But
see, I'm aware now that I didn't think you could do it because I bought the myth that thought and action can't go together, and I knew how smart you were.
Well, I won't say anything about how smart I am, but. You know, you see this thing, same thing, playing out again on a much bigger stage with Barack Obama. And right now, where we are in the campaign, on both sides, the Republicans who oppose him and some of the left supporters of him are shocked and disappointed to find out that he's actually a politician.
A politician, I know.
Right. And see, this is the thing, is that I think Obama is at a much higher level and a more skillful level than me, is in the same situation, that if you get in and get your hands dirty and you get into the grubbiness of real life and you make the kind of accommodations you do and you try to navigate the moral hazards that involve...
That are required.
That's really what we want. We want a good politician who's skillful and maybe wily. And it can use words carefully, and that doesn't mean that you don't want somebody who's a liar, but you actually want somebody who's skillful at persuading people, who can talk differently to different audiences. And so the people who buy into the Philosopher King model think that they're being betrayed.
Yes.
Because
yes.
You've got a politician here. But on the other hand, when we put people up, who think that it's beneath them to engage in politics, they lose.
They lose. I was just going to say, they lose.
Or they fail.
Right.
So
because it's required. That skill is required to function in that situation.
That's right. And the skill is exactly the right word. It's the word for virtue, which we tend to take as somebody who's prudish, is the same root word as virtuosity. Right. So virtue really, it means a skill to be able to do something extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what we want is a virtuous politician. It doesn't mean somebody who never shades the truth or never compromises or never reevaluates a position on the basis of what's possible to accomplish.
Or never makes a pragmatic choice.
Never makes a pragmatic choice. Virtue, so we've got to get this straight. We should, I think people should be reassured.
Yes.
That, in fact, Obama is the people. One of my favorite phrases they say, he turns out just to be a Chicago politician.
Oh.
Great!
Yay!
That's exactly what we need, is somebody who's trained in Chicago-style politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that somebody trained in Chicago-style politics will deal much better with the Middle East than either that sort of macho cowboy attitude of, you know, let's just push people around and show them that we're stronger and mightier than them. Divorce thought from action. Or somebody who thinks that you can be, you know, a philosopher king and pure and never make compromises and never cut deals. Neither of those models will work.
While I'm listening to you, I'm thinking how this requires to hold on to this idea. Requires a kind of complexity of thought. It's not simple.
Right.
And I think that's very difficult for people. Maybe it's American.
Yeah.
This black and white,
Well, you know, we also, I mean, I sort of to beat that same drum is that we have this sort of notion that if we get somebody whose motives are pure or who's just like us or so on and so forth, that we'll get good outcomes. But you would never take that attitude about a physician or a musician or a car mechanic. You would want somebody who's really skilled at the task they attend to. And we don't really think that way about politicians, but there are skills involved in it, and there's a certain kind of self-discipline and thought. And I think the hardest part of the whole thing is to be expedient and crafty
and not lose yourself.
And not lose yourself in your moral vision, moral guidance.
Your compass, yeah.
And that is something that actually takes thought and discipline, and you have to practice it, and you'll make mistakes. But we don't really respect that. We think that somehow we should get Jimmy Stewart in
Mrs. Smith Goes to Washington,
and everything will just be fine.
Fine. I don't know whether this is the same thing, but I had a conversation with a client today, and she is doing something that her family will badly disapprove of, and she's 50. And if she tells her mother and father, they're going to give her a very hard time. It will be just a horrible conversation. And I said, well, don't tell them. And it took me a long time to convince her that truth for its own sake, that was just going to hurt everybody, was not necessary. You know, it just wasn't necessary. No one will be hurt by the fact that they don't know, and everybody will benefit.
Right. And, you know, this is, again, I mean, I guarantee you, you won't have many conversations with elected officials where the touchstone keeps going back to the Greeks. But the ancient Greeks understood that politics and truth would always have a tenuous relationship. Because a skillful politician, in order to accomplish good things, will occasionally hold back information, shade a truth, and so forth. It's part of the tools of the trade, in a sense, to shade the truth. The hard part, again, is being disciplined about that. If you're going to give yourself permission to develop skills in being wily, then you may be giving yourself permission also to abandon all moral constraints.
Yeah.
And that's a very dangerous thing. And so you really need people who are well-grounded and well-centered morally if they're going to engage in this. But the difference between that inherent tension in truth and politics, just as truth with lots of other kind of interpersonal skills and so forth, because we all do what you're talking about. The question is, how do you do it well and right and appropriately and with a sense of self-constraint or restraint? The difference between then and now is that now we have organized lying on a massive scale.
God, yes.
And, you know, there's a great political philosopher. My favorite political philosopher is a woman named Hannah Arendt. And she wrote a great essay called Truth in Politics, and this was her point. The 20th century, with the technology that we have and with the knowledge that we've developed about how psychology works and so forth, allows us to organize lying on a massive scale so that it becomes just a fundamental feature of the entire endeavor of doing politics. We always tend to think that technology will get us out of these problems, but you know, you see with the internet, it maybe undercuts the monopoly of large corporate ownership of the dissemination of information, but that also leads to this smear campaign, for again going back to Obama, where
right.
It's very hard to snuff this thing out because these emails continue to disseminate and these unpoliced and unaccountable websites pop up and disappear and they... You know,
and you can't find them.
You cannot find them. You can't hold anybody responsible. So the technology really doesn't solve the problem. It just changes the venue. In fact, it becomes more complicated. So, you know, that's the new age of the 20th century and 21st century is that sort of ordinary realm of a little bit of deception here, a little bit of shading there, now becomes a scientific endeavor with huge organization behind it.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, and that is the importance of having a strong moral center and the difficulty of holding on to it. Maybe it comes down to what what the definition of, you know, moral compass is, what it means to have strong sense of what is actually right and what is actually wrong.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems with it, we don't really allow ourselves to talk about morality and ethics in the public sphere. It's sort of seen as impolite, especially, again, sort of for left intellectuals, it's totally impolite, unless you're a professional philosopher or something, to talk about these things. Because we somewhere got this kind of phobia that if I talked about what I thought was right, that I would be imposing that on you, and that would be an insult, you know, because maybe we have different religious backgrounds or whatever, and so it would be a sign of disrespect. And that then sort of surrenders the ground to people who think about morality, I think, in very simplistic terms. So in politics, as with a lot of other more complex realms of life, a lot of time morality is a matter of judgment, which isn't to say it's strictly subjective or strictly situational. It's a matter of judgment, and judgment by its nature is complicated. It's a weighing of various different things. It means that you can't come up with a simple universal rule that can apply in every case. It means, in fact, you might have competing goods at play in one thing and competing prohibitions at play in one thing, and you somehow have to weigh that. So to be good at the bringing morality into politics is something that takes a lot of skill and practice, and it's complicated.
And thought.
And thought. And we've surrendered moral talk to people who, you know, make simplistic judgments. So, you know, if you sort of think about it, I know it's not perfect, but if you think about that Kohlberg scale of moral development, do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't think I do.
Okay, well, there's a guy named Kohlberg.
Oh, I do know. I studied it.
Yeah.
Yes, and then the top one is...
Well, yeah, that's actually where the dispute comes, because, okay, so the idea is that part of our cognitive development as we go through life, among other things, we get more and more sophisticated about moral judgment. So
yeah, it starts out that you do what they say you should do because they're going to punish you, then because they like you, then because it's right and wrong, and
right.
like that, right?
Right, exactly. The point is that as you get older, you hope that you progress through these different stages and become more sophisticated. So when you move away from moral absolutes, it's not a regression into license. It's a progression into a more demanding way of thinking about things. It's harder, not easier.
I was having some conversation with a very good friend, somebody I know a very long time, and he suddenly looked at me and said, "My God, you're a relativist." He was shocked. I said, "Well, I guess I am.
You know, so again, if you deal in the realm of concrete absolutes, someone who says, "Maybe it depends," sounds like
a relativist. That's right.
All right, but not necessarily so. It may be, in fact, that what you're recognizing is that there are competing goods at play in a practical situation. And so the complex thing is, how do you weigh those and figure out what is most compelling, or maybe there's some kind of middle path. Well, that's not relativist in the sense that anything goes, I choose what I want. It's actually taking on a harder burden of thinking, digging deeper to figure out. So, you know, I have people in my orbit who are very concrete. I think most of us have these in our families, you know, who think that if you're not following certain rules, then you must be an immoral person. But I think that what we really want from our political leaders is sort of what we'd expect of ourselves, is that not that we abandon any sense of moral constraint, but that we actually demand a little bit more of ourselves, that we think about these things. In politics, it's just rife with that,
yeah.
Right? And you do have the reality that you're dealing with egos, you're dealing with the constraints of institutions. Maybe you would like to throw those institutions out, but even to do that usually requires you operate within the ones you have. You know, so you've got that. You're dealing with people, you know, the ego part of it, I think, in practical politics is a huge thing. A lot of it comes down to interpersonal relationships. The interpersonal skills, that's sort of a fascinating part of when you try to apply this stuff, because I think that I've developed some pretty good relationships with some pretty conservative members of the other party. And what that means is that when we move into certain areas where we're not going to be driven apart on the basis of ideology or something like that, because we recognize intelligence and there's a certain level of trust that even though you might differ in judgment, you basically trust that the person has some good instincts, you can work together in that sphere. Then the very next topic, you may be total enemies until the end of that conversation or that debate, and you have to be able to navigate that. And again, there's a kind of self-discipline there because, you know, your normal tendency is you're fighting it out with somebody on an issue, you want to think that's a bad person.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
I mean, that's just our instinct. To be competitive almost implies a kind of willingness to objectify
the other person, and obliterate them.
if it comes to that. But if you're going to be good at politics, you have to, if you're trying to pursue some higher good, you've got to be willing to build coalitions on one issue and throw them overboard the next and build a new one. And that means your enemy one day is your friend the next. And so you have to...
You have to keep moving.
I always think of the Warner Brothers cartoon of the sheepdog and the wolf. Do you remember that?
No, I guess not.
Well, it's a great cartoon. So they come to work in the morning, they punch in, and you know, the wolf says, sheepdog says the wolf, morning Sam and morning Frank, and you know, then they go out into the field and then they spend the entire day trying to kill each other. And then at the end of the cartoon they check out again.
Right?
And that's the way it should be, really. You ought to be able to do this. That requires a commitment to civility.
Yes.
You know, so that there should be... And this is, it goes back to the thing of citizen participation, because we sort of threw out a lot of babies in the bathwaters and the countercultural movement in the 60s, which I still have huge sympathies, threw out babies with bathwaters. And the idea that if you maintain a kind of formality and civility that you're really a phony was a very bad idea. Having a kind of public face is crucial for being able to behave civilly toward other people. So when you get into a legislative situation, for example, it's very important that everyone behave according to some strict rules. They actually formalize them. Mm-hmm. So for example, you never address the other member on the floor. You address the chair. So you may refer to the other member, you say, Madam Chair, I rise today in opposition to the argument made by my colleague. You don't say, you jerk.
Yeah, right.
You got it wrong again,
right?
Well, you know, so of course that's sort of phony and formal and stilted, but it's what keeps you from going over and whacking the person over the head,
right.
And what allows you then in the next conversation or when the day is done, to rehumanize the person.
Right.
And so all of that stuff is important. And these are skills that we don't really...
Boy, you're going to take the words right out of my mouth. I'm thinking, where do you learn these?
Yeah, and we don't really inculcate that.
We don't even mention them.
Right. Well, in fact, we denigrate it.
Yes.
You know, as I say, people who are skilled at that, we think of as phony politicians. And we sort of think, well, we want are
real people.
Who won't do that. Well, real people then are very ineffective at getting things done because they yell at each other all the time.
But, you know, I'm thinking, where are the mentors for this? Where are the people that you can go to not only to learn it, but to help you when you're having trouble finding your footing, you know? Like, where are the elders, whatnots?
We used to teach this stuff in schools, and it was thrown out
with music and art.
Right, exactly. And there were good reasons why people were very suspicious of it, because part of when we had classes called civics, and you learned all those formal rules, but it was also a kind of justification of the status quo that some people found very suspicious, largely on the left, sometimes from the right as well. So, you know, we sort of started throwing out the civics part and focusing more, say, on the history and the social science, which I'm, you know, completely approve of, since I'm a historically oriented social scientist by trade. I don't have anything against that. But we don't really teach civics. And, you know, used to do that kind of stuff in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we actually institutionalized this. we've thrown most of that stuff out.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what Robert Putnam talks about in the book of Bowling Alone, that there used to be these sort of civic associations that served as vehicles for the transmission of this from one generation to another. We've lost a lot of that. You know, we spend more of our time in the automobile and in gated communities.
And behind computers.
We don't interact with people. So there's something really being lost. And then that makes, at the end of the day, makes politics harder. Okay. And it's part of, again, why it's easy for us, when we're sitting at the computer screen, encountering politics as other people in distant places who are virtual rather than real. They're all liars and jerks, and they're bad people. They're different from us. They disagree, and we call them names, question their motives, and so forth. And it's because it's divorced from these practical settings where you learn how to do this stuff the right way.
So I don't know about you, obviously, but I find this discussion absolutely fascinating, as you can tell, because you can hear me reacting. I find this, the thoughtfulness of it, so essential. This is the kind of conversation that we are not at all having in our culture. The way the political parties state their case, as we all know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, it's sound bites and attacks and counterattacks. And the more thoughtful, intellectual, philosophical that would include us. I don't know if you heard it in what Keith is saying, but he's so inclusive. He finds a way, and in the next interview you'll hear it even more, because I'm busy being exclusive, and he's continually showing me how my exclusive position is endangering even what I want, and how it's possible to be inclusive. So amazing lesson that I fell into the trap myself, and I like to think of myself as bigger than that, better than that, but I clearly was not. And so that's what you have to look forward to next week if you are interested in the second half of the interview. Now I'm going to tell you more about camouflage. When there's a change we want to make, and that change would really endanger us, but we don't want to know that. We want to just keep focusing on it. Our unconscious will create a camouflage problem for us to deal with. Now, I want to explain this, even though I talked about it at length in the last show. I want to explain it in case you didn't hear the last show, and also because this is not an easy concept to get. So even if you heard the last show, hearing it again is probably not going to hurt. Our unconscious takes a problem that we already have and blows it out of all kind of proportion and focuses our attention on it and also makes sure we can't solve it. That's how you know a problem is camouflage, that no matter what you do, you can't solve this problem. No matter how much energy you put into it, how much attention, you can't fix it. It undermines you somehow. It sneaks up and bites you in the ass. Often, this is because that's a problem that your unconscious has focused your attention on to keep you from focusing on something that you're not ready to do, to distract you from a problem or solution that would cause more pain. Now, when you know that something is camouflage, that doesn't mean it's not real. The unconscious is very, very clever, and it picks real problems for us to focus on. But it won't let you solve the problem as long as it needs it as camouflage. So it's really useful to figure out if this thing that has been driving you crazy is camouflage or not. Because if it is, you can stop worrying about it. And you can start thinking about what it might be that you're not focused on. In this show, I'm going to describe the camouflage problem of weight, being overweight, which is epidemic in our culture. Everybody is thinking about their weight. In the future shows, I'm going to talk about other equally compelling camouflage problems. But in this show, I am going to talk about the focus on our weight and how it successfully diverts us from other kinds of issues. So, as you certainly know, in our society, being overweight is a common problem, doesn't even begin to touch it. I mean, there's almost nobody who isn't thinking about their weight. Hundreds of thousands of people are obsessed by how much they weigh. An indication of how many people have camouflage weight problems is how the weight loss industry has just boomed. Dozens of new industries have sprung up to address this need. Where it used to just be that there were fad diets and people would, you know, play with them from time to time, weight loss programs now have become a way of life for so many people. People for whom weight loss is a camouflage problem focus all their attention on it. Their lives revolve around the struggle to lose weight. They scrutinize their body, comparing themselves endlessly to everyone they encounter. They calculate calories, they read diet books, they enroll in weight loss programs, they sign up for health clubs, they buy expensive equipment, they constantly evaluate their progress, endlessly losing and gaining the same 5, 25, or even 50 pounds. Many diligently apply themselves to the problem, but they don't solve it. And that's what makes it a camouflage problem. Does this sound familiar? Are you always worrying about or talking about your weight? Do you spend much of your free time reading books about weight loss or related subjects? Are you weight program literate, having tried every weight program on the market? Are food, exercise, and concealing clothing your favorite topics of conversation? When no matter what you do, you can't solve your problem, suspect camouflage. If a weight problem is a camouflage problem, its goal is to distract you, and by distracting you, to protect you from a larger and more profound danger. Well, you may be thinking, what could be a more profound danger? This weight's driving me crazy. I would be so much happier if I were thinner. And this can be true for people who want to lose 10 pounds and people who want to lose 100 pounds. You know, my clothes would fit me better. I would feel better about myself. My health would be better. I would be able to do these things that I can't now do. I'd feel good about myself. I'd be, you know, more attractive. Well, I mean, there's just no downside to losing weight, right? If you were listening to some of the earlier shows, then you heard me talking about an exercise that I give and gave in that show, actually, called What Would Happen If? What would happen if you magically made the change you want to make? And then when you do this exercise, you're supposed to be looking for the positives of that change and also the negatives. Because I believe if you can't make the change, there are negatives. You're just not focusing on them. So I'm going to tell you a story now, and if there's time at the end of the show, I'm going to tell you another one, of a client who came to see me, who came to talk about losing weight, and where we discovered why the camouflage problem of weight was the easier problem to solve and what was the bigger danger that her unconscious was distracting her from. When June came to see me, she wanted to put an end to her lifelong struggle with weight. Her parents had been very religious, and they considered the human body sinful. At 35 years old, June could still clearly remember one summer evening when she was only 3 or 4. She'd found a feather boa that her mother had had, and wearing only that, she paraded into the living room. Her parents blushed and awkwardly sent her from the room for punishment. June decided there and then, and of course there were lots of other examples of this in her life, this just confirmed it for her, that her impulse to show off her body was shameful. As she grew into a young woman, June's father called her friends who dated tramps, and when June herself was finally allowed to date, she was admonished to be very careful. June was ashamed of her body. To hide it, she created an unattractive cover and literally buried her body under the cover of layers of fat. Now, this is another concept, the undercover concept, which I talk about in detail in an earlier show. And although I haven't said it yet, I'll say it now and maybe I'll say it later. All those shows are on my website. And if any of the concepts that I mention in passing that I've talked about in earlier shows intrigue you or interest you and you want to hear more about that, you can click on my website, which is thelynnshow.com, and you can listen to the podcasts there. You can buy the book also, and the audiobook and the workbook. But if you're just interested in a little snippet of information about it, you can listen to the podcast. And I must say that if you Google thelynnshow.com, and that's L-Y-N-N-E, The Lynn Show, Google will bring up two hits. And the first one is the old website, which I am trying to get deleted but have not yet. And the second one is the new version where all the podcasts work. Okay, enough. And now having heard the commercial, I'll get back to June. So I was saying that she had covered her body in layers of fat. She may have buried her body undercover, but she couldn't bury her sexuality. And even at her fattest, she was still attracted to men. I asked June the what-if question, the one I was talking about before, what would happen if she were thinner? After she explored the upside, all those things I said, you know, she'd be thinner, she'd be happier, her clothes would fit her, and all that stuff, she came upon her catastrophic expectation and said, well, there'd be no stopping me. June believed that if she had a sexier body, she wouldn't be able to contain her sexuality, and her parents would despise her. The vision of her mother's tears and her father's red face were enough to undermine her most determined exercise program. Before June could lose her weight, she had to feel safe enough to expose her sexuality. And before she could expose her sexuality, she had to be able to tolerate disappointing her parents. She had to be able to endure suffering their bad opinion of her. As long as this was too great a danger for June to face, her unconscious kept her fascinated by all these things related to weight loss, but it wouldn't let her lose the weight. Now understand that recognizing that the danger that June was avoiding by focusing on this camouflage problem of weight allowed her to know where the real work was. The work of differentiating from her parents, of giving up the sense of responsibility for making her parents happy, of being able to tolerate that her parents would be embarrassed by her, despise her, be ashamed of her, criticize her, or even ignore her, neglect her, not want to have anything to do with her. That was serious work. That was serious danger. And so, of course, all of the work shifted from the trying to lose weight to making peace with the fact that her parents had unrealistic expectations, that her sexual impulses were actually quite normal, natural, healthy, to be enjoyed, to be reveled in, and not to be hidden from. Okay, if there's time, at the end of the show, I'm going to tell you a story about another client. In the meanwhile, I hope that you're wondering if weight is your camouflage problem. It may not be. You may be one of the lucky ones for whom weight is just, you know, you like your weight and you watch what you eat, but you're not obsessed with it. But if you're somebody who fits this profile, a day, an hour doesn't go by where you're not somehow thinking about how you're going to be thinner, please take a moment to do the what-if question. What would happen if you were suddenly as thin as you think you'd like to be? And after you've written down all of the good things, see if you can find your catastrophic expectation. And of course, if you find that, I would be happy to have that information. So please do go up on my website and click on Contact Me and tell me what you've discovered or any other comment that you have to make. So now I think I have enough time to tell you a story of another client of mine who also came to see me for weight loss. She didn't need to lose nearly the weight that June needed to lose, but she needed to lose 10, 15, maybe 20 pounds. Her career, she thought, was at stake. She was an entertainer, and she thought that these extra pounds were really hurting her ability to be successful. And she was what she labeled, self-styled, as the diet queen. She could do every diet, and she did them all extremely well, and she would lose weight on everything. And then there would come the magic moment, the plateau, and she couldn't lose any more weight than that. And this really made her angry, and she didn't understand it. And so I did the same exercise with her, the what would happen if. And that didn't actually bear any fruit for us, and so I did some guided imagery with her, which I do a lot of, and actually I do some guided imagery in some of the early shows. And maybe if there's time, I'll do a little here. I don't know if there's time. But what came up in the guided imagery with this client was that when she was little, her father beat her. And as he was hitting her, she was saying to herself, if I were big, he couldn't do this. And so big came to mean a certain size. And her unconscious, or to use the sort of psycho language, her inner child, was saying, we're not getting any smaller than this, because getting smaller than this is to be endangered of being hurt. We're not. And so her emphasis on weight was, instead of doing what she had to do, which was deal with her inner fear that she was still vulnerable to be hurt. And when she dealt with that, she didn't have to struggle about the weight at all, because it just fell off. So, actually, I think we could do this. Perhaps you can close your eyes and allow your body to relax as much as it possibly can. And I'm fond of saying that even when we've told our body to relax, some part of our body holds on. And you can learn a lot by finding out what part of your body is holding on. So if you've told your body to relax and you scan it and you notice that your elbows are out or your shoulders are still up by your ears or your hands are clenched, your jaw is tight, or your toes are curled, then this is the place where you're holding extra tension. And you want to thank that part of your body and tell it that for the moment it can relax. And maybe then you could focus on your breathing. Just notice that you are breathing. And that you don't have to try and breathe, and actually you can't stop yourself from breathing. That's a naturally occurring event in your body. And in the same way that your lungs don't need instruction about how to get oxygen inside you, your unconscious does not need instruction about how to share with you information about what danger you might be avoiding as you focus on losing weight. So I'm going to give you a minute, and during that minute I'm going to play a little piece of music. And when that minute is up, I'll talk again, and we'll see whether you've learned anything. So, did anything occur to you? Did you get any information? This information can come in so many ways. Our unconscious is just so clever, so it could be an idea, you know, just like other ideas. It could be a random thought that kind of slips in that you're unprepared for or are surprised by. It can be a song title or a sort of snatch of a song, you know, that goes by. It could be a cartoon. It could be a memory. You could see, actually, an old event. It could be something that you know really well but didn't put in this context, or something you'd forgotten all about. Your unconscious can do whatever it wants to, or it could be nothing. And if you did get some idea, some information, something occurred to you, don't go rushing off into thinking that you have to do something about it. So I'm the woman who wrote the book When You Can, You Will. And this may just be the beginning of a process in which you finally do make peace with this, solve it, resolve it, whatever it is. But if you did get some information about something else, and you suspect that weight may be a camouflage problem for you, perhaps you can stop working so hard at it. You can continue to try and lose your weight, but stop being so hard on yourself. Understand that some of the reason that you can't lose this weight may be related to the fact that it will uncover a deeper danger, and that you're only just beginning to recognize what that deeper danger is, and you're going to start to think about how to solve that, how to protect yourself from that. And of course, if you want to share that information with me, I am happy to have it. Please go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, and click on Contact Me and email me. So, this is the end of this show, and as always, I need to thank Josh Hackney. Any of you who have been listening know that I do that every week, because there would be no show without Josh. Josh is not only terrifically skilled in all of the things that I need that have to do with electronics and computer and recording, but he's incredibly kind and generous. And it's my view that those things, competence and skill and kindness and generosity, don't always go together, in the same way that intellectual curiosity and philosophical acumen do not always accompany political interest. So, if you want to hear more from Keith, which, frankly, I can't imagine that you don't want to, but you may not. But if you do, then you can tune in next week, and he will be there. So I want to say, as I always do, that I really hope that you got something useful from this show, or something that engaged you or entertained you, but at least something that will make you want to come back. Because I'll be here next week, and so will Keith, and I sure hope that you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into the that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. From the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten